Let's turn that crown upside down. It's time for Architecture, Coffee, and Ink. Hello, this is Hollywood C, and you're listening to Architecture, Coffee, and Ink, a podcast dedicated to introducing concepts, detailing out designs, and tackling the architecture you might not realize the meaning behind. I'm your hostess, and I am here today to start introducing you to the designs that make you wonder why. So I ask you to brew your coffee, grab your sketchbook and pen, and let's begin. Hello again to all my dear listeners and Inkwell designers. Welcome. I hope that everyone has had a good couple of weeks. If you have been here for every episode or this is your first time, thank you for joining us today. Before diving into today's episode on the Statue of Liberty, let's do some brief housekeeping and catching up. I'm not sure how everyone else's schedules are looking right now, but I feel like I have had a super busy time lately. During the last few weeks, I got the opportunity to do some hands-on research during a trip to Salem, Massachusetts, and it was amazing to be there after the Tunnels episode. If you are a new listener, go check out the Tunnels Part 1 if you want to hear all about what's lurking beneath Salem. We had an amazing time doing a designer's tour of Salem, and I don't want to spoil the surprise, but wait for an announcement from me soon about a piece that me and my friend are co-writing for the blog. Now, on to today's episode. This is one of the minisodes that I ended up expanding on quite a bit, because if no one cuts me off, I will just keep editing and rewriting, and because there is so much information about the Statue of Liberty, I've broken up the topic into several episodes. For today's episode, we are going to focus primarily on the evolution of the design, including the history, a bit about the sculptor, and bringing it to America. Just a reminder that this is one of the topics being covered as part of our New York City art, focusing on the city and its history. I also have a personal connection to the statue, one that literally millions of others in the world share. My family were some of the 8 million who immigrated through Ellis Island long after the Statue of Liberty had been erected in the harbor. On the same day that my little cousin would be born some years later, my family saw her slowly getting larger as their boat entered New York Harbor in the New World. Instead of the more traditional directions, the statue faces southeast, so all ships entering see her welcome them in her awe-inspiring entirety. Any and all times that she was visible even slightly while being out and about in New York City, Lady Liberty was immediately pointed out by my family. I understood why she was important, but I didn't fully grasp the impact of her presence, more than likely due to my youth and inability to understand, as to me, driving in a car seems like forever, and the concept of a ship voyage was limited primarily to ferries, fishing, and canoes. Though I would get excited every time I saw her, as it meant we were nearing the end of my car journey, I didn't exactly grasp the same level of impact. I didn't understand that after days, weeks, or months at sea, she was the beckoning symbol of freedom, and a promise that peace was so close at hand, that for many who immigrated, she was the first to greet them, and to let them know that they'd almost reached the end of their journey. But for many, the fight wasn't over once they arrived, and for countless more, the fight for equality had barely begun. These concepts we will visit in detail in part 2. We are going to kick off this episode with the history. However, since we've already gone over the history of New York City itself, we are just going to focus exclusively on the statue. If you need a refresher on NYC or the history of the region, please go back to episode number 35, Hello New York. On even an international level, the Statue of Liberty has been personified in songs, nicknamed Lady Liberty, and been a long-standing symbol of freedom and beacon of hope. Formally, the statue is titled Liberty Enlightening the World, though I will probably call her Lady Liberty most of the episode, as that's honestly how I normally addressed her in casual conversations. Her meaning is not limited to just a location, but has evolved instead to be a symbol of freedom and peace. Multiple copies have been erected around the globe, and she has been used as a symbol for several protest and freedom and equality activists. She has guest starred in various movies, including Ghostbusters 2. Unlike normal, I am going to start by taking a moment to shout out a source. As always, I list them all on the episode transcripts, which I'm currently working to post on the blog. One I wanted to highlight in the show itself was Raising the Torch, which is a mini-series from the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation. It was a really good introduction if you're looking to dive into the topic. Of course, that does remind me. Always remember to check your sources, check your facts, and most importantly, check me. Like any good researcher, make sure to always check your information with multiple sources. And when I inevitably mispronounce something, please know that I am not trying to be rude. This show is dedicated to celebrating all of the people and cultures we discuss. For today's episode, I'm going to start by taking you back to the late 1800s. I am going to give you the official narrative of how the statue came to be, or at least what the public was led to believe the story was. Because as we continue through the history and the design, we will learn that once again, what sells isn't necessarily what's true. In 1865, a French sculptor named Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi was at a dinner held at the Versailles, France-based estate of his employer, Edouard de Le Boullier, a French historian. Le Boullier was also an abolitionist and a strong supporter of former President Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln had been assassinated on April 15, 1865, and most associated his assassination with the end of the war. However, the American Civil War would not officially end until a year later, in 1866, with President Johnson's Proclamation 157 on August 20th. Bartholdi was commissioned to create a statue or a bust of Le Boullier. Over the course of this evening, which some sources make sound much more extravagant than others, Le Boullier apparently proposed the idea of something to pay homage to the great relationship between the French and the American, particularly celebrating the Franco-American alliance of the American Revolution. In light of the Civil War drawing to a close and the abolishment of slavery, this statue would be a homage to freedom. And with this idea proposed and so moved and motivated, he and Bartholdi set forth to create the Statue of Liberty. Beautiful story, right? It has it all. A call to arms, patriotic themes, and the power of friendship. And for countless years, this was the story being told. But with a report by the National Park Service in 2000, it has been confirmed that this is a story Bartholdi wrote as a fundraising effort in 1885, after the death of Le Boullier in 1883. And while elements of the story are probably true, it didn't unfold quite as neatly in reality. So let's tell the whole truth. And to do that, we are going to talk about Bartholdi. We need to talk about him and his background first to understand just where Le Boullier comes into the story and how America got its Lady Liberty. Le Boullier may be considered the father of the statue, but Bartholdi is the sculptor. Bartholdi was born in 1834 in Colmar, France, which is located in the Alsace region. To give a bit of geographical context that will come into play later on, this is the area just across the Rhine River from Germany. His mother, Augusta Charlotte Bessier Bartholdi, moved all the children to Paris after the death of his father, and while he was there, he attended the Lycée Louis Le Grand. The Lycée is a school that has been offering high-quality education since 1563 through the current day, according to the school website. After graduating, he received his first commission, a statue of General Jean Rapp, nicknamed the Intrepid, as he served in both the Revolution and Napoleonic Wars. For those who don't know, being able to work for a general straight out of school would have been a pretty big achievement. And while this shows he had already demonstrated a high skill at sculpting at a young age, it was his trip to Egypt that led him to discover his true calling. Around 1855 through 56, he went on a trip with either French ambassadors or painters and artists, where he came into contact with multiple colossal statues. Now, when I say colossal, I mean that these were all statues that were an exaggerated size, but overall maintained the same proportions of humans and animals. I'm gonna be honest, there's a lot of back and forth between sources on who exactly accompanied him on this trip. This discrepancy makes sense, as he tends to jazz up the truth to help raise money for the statue. One of the ways was he wrote and sold pamphlets with facts and stories about the statue, including the story from the introduction that we know is a bit of a dramatization. Throughout the rest of the episode, I may hesitate or say either or, and it's not because I decided to be lazy with research. It's more I wasn't able to determine in some cases what was propaganda. Getting back to the trip, among these were the Colossi of Minoan, a pair of statues of Pharaoh Imhotep III. Now, this is the clearest example of how much of an impact experiencing something firsthand can be if you're fortunate enough to have the means to do so. In his classical training, he would have studied several other colossal statues, but the focus more than likely would have been on ancient Greece and Rome. However, it wasn't until he saw the various Colossi in person that it ensnared him in a lifelong affair. I have a quote from him that has been included on almost every source I used for this episode. This passage is his description of the Colossi Minoan. Quote, These granite beings, in their imperturbable majesty, seem to be still listening to the utmost remote antiquity. Their kindly and impassable glaze seems to ignore the present and be fixed upon an unlimited future. The design itself expresses, after a fashion, infinity. As you can tell from the quote, it was more to him than just a giant pile of rock. The statues stand at over 70 feet tall and are at the respectable age of well over 3,200 years old. But for me, something that stands out from his words is the reference to the design expressing infinity, or this idea of the immortality of design. Living forever through design has been discussed in depth long before me. In fact, I would imagine that many of the designers listening to this episode are cringing in memory of at least one essay topic on the subject from school. But hold this idea in your head for a moment of the immortality an artist can achieve through design, as we will revisit it later next episode. Getting back to Bartholdi, ancient Egyptian style captivated him so much that he returned for another visit in 1868, and then he reached a point in his life where he decided to submit his first attempt at a massive colossus. He was proposing a statue that would commemorate the creation of the Suez Canal. And here's where a lot of misinformation of the Statue of Liberty comes from. But first, what is the canal, and how does this original statue cause all this confusion? Well, for a multitude of sources, she's considered to be the first draft of the Statue of Liberty. When you are researching online, you'll see an assortment of clickbait articles with titles with multiple exclamation points and disclaimers. The general idea is normally some variation of how the Statue of Liberty was almost in Egypt. I have a slightly different interpretation of this, and this is going to seem like a little bit of a side tangent at first, but it's important in understanding the Statue of Liberty. Starting in April 1859, construction began on the Suez Canal and lasted until it opened for use in 1869. This opening happened shortly after Bartholdi proposed his idea to Khedive Ismail Pasha of Egypt. The Suez Canal would operate as a path between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, and while it was later elongated, when it opened, it was roughly 164 kilometers or 101 miles. For those who aren't familiar with your geography, this means that instead of having to go around Africa or caravanning overland, boats would now be able to cross a short distance in an artificial waterway and reach the rest of Asia with ease. Prior to this, an assortment of attempts to find better and safer travel routes had already been undertaken in just about every combination you can think of, including Ferdinando de Magellan, or as many of you know him, Ferdinand Magellan, who had already had his ill-fated attempt to be among the first to circumnavigate the globe from 1519 through 1522. Although he personally died in the Philippines in 1521 along the way, part of his crew succeeded, but not without high loss and trauma. Fact, while it was on the voyage, it was discovered that Enrique, or Henrique, of Meldeca, a slave on the ship, had already been the first person to go completely around the globe several years prior. Either way, it was realized that attempting to go west, to go the long way around, wasn't a good option either because of how treacherous the passage was. So going around Africa was the best option, as it provided the quickest passage holding the most goods. However, in addition to the journey itself being incredibly long and full of dangers from the sea, storms, and pirates, the land itself fought against conquest. Bartholdi spent hours working on this design, and she was based on a real-life model. The model was a fellah, or present, and we pretty much know nothing about the real-life person, but we do have the drawings and the title of the proposed project, formally titled Egypt Carrying the Light to Asia, or Progress. So let's walk through the design of Lady Progress. At the most basic elements, this is a woman on a pedestal in the water, holding aloft a torch in the air with one hand, beckoning forward all those who entered the canal towards her. When Bartholdi first proposed this design, it was rejected, and several elements were asked to be changed. Among these are the way that she's holding the light and what that light is. A torch versus a jar, for example, and whether it is in the hand or being carried on the head. I saw several sources argue that what she was wearing wasn't the traditional headdress, but instead a crown. I strongly believe that the situation is very similar to the Mona Lisa phenomenon. By now, multiple people have seen multiple sketches at multiple points in their life. It's not surprising that things have become muddled in the annals of history with several sketches and versions floating around. However many sketches Bartholdi made, the design was submitted twice before it was rejected due to a lack of funds. In each of the drawings, she's dressed in a flowing robe, which cascades down to her feet with her light aloft in the air. Now, here's where I started to struggle a bit with the narrative. It seems like a lot of sources have a bit of a time skip or go off on a tangent about how Bartholdi was brought into the front lines for ongoing war efforts, and then suddenly we have him sailing over to America with letters of introduction from Le Boullier, and somehow he's kicking off the fundraising efforts for the Statue of Liberty. After he left Egypt, an in-between trip, he returned to France where he produced several statues and sculptures, taking both public and private commissions. I bring this up because a lot of sources seem to romanticize him and remove the work and effort that he put into building a reputation, while in reality, he was establishing himself and working as a sculptor and at one point studied architecture. Somewhere during this, he comes together with Le Boullier. I would hazard a guess that it was over the course of several conversations that they came forward with the fully designed idea of creating the Statue of Liberty. Whether or not the initial inspiration struck during a dinner party after one too many wines, or whether it was slowly fleshed out, detailed and decided in the study in front of a crackling fire. Altogether, work on the statue is officially credited as beginning in 1865, starting from the initial idea. Some combination of Le Boullier and Bartholdi are responsible for brainstorming the idea of commemorating the relationship between the French and Americans. Additionally, we know that without Le Boullier's influence, nothing would have occurred. Unfortunately, at this point is where the war interjects into the story. Bartholdi served as a squadron leader in the Franco-Prussian War, which kicked off in July 1870. During this time, all progress on the Statue of Liberty was halted. Under the leadership of Napoleon III, France, and Bartholdi as a citizen, were caught in the war against Prussia and Germany. While France would lose the war and see a regime change, during the war, Bartholdi served in his hometown. His squadron fought on the front lines there, however, they ended up surrendering, and his hometown was officially declared to be underneath German rule when they annexed Colmar. He created several other statues in honor of the war, which I will cover in an Article of the Week segment this Friday on the blog. But in the year 1871, Bartholdi then reset his sights back onto the Statue of Liberty, and, armed with letters of introduction from Le Boullier, headed to America to drum up support. The purpose of this initial trip was to help set up a committee to raise funds in America and create support for the statue. They ended up dividing the project into two parts: the statue itself, which would be completed in France and paid for by them, and then the pedestal or base, which would be the responsibility of the USA. On a trip, he discovered his preferred location, which is called Bedloe's Island. It was home to an active military base, Fort Wood, that I will talk about in more depth in the next episode. Unfortunately, he was not the one who was supposed to pick the final location of the statue in New York City, but after a probably nerve-wracking period, the American committee did choose the island, which would eventually be renamed Liberty Island. As he was getting started, he seemingly discovered that unlike in Egypt, his vision was being approved with relatively little pushback, which probably should have been his first warning sign. The one thing that the American committee was initially upset about was that America also had to contribute funds. And here's where we get into some of my favorite parts of this story. The first thing to know is that the statue is not a gift from one government to another. This statue was funded by the people, for the people, and this will make a lot more sense in a few minutes. With the American committee set up, Bartholdi returned to France to work at the warehouse of Gidget, Gother & Co. Our Lady was built in France between the years 1875 to 1884 from the drafts that were created between the years 1870 to 71. For those who may not be familiar with the difference between a draft versus a sketch is a broad idea and concept, whereas drafting is more of the technical drawing. During that time period, it was assembled and displayed in Paris, during which parts of the statues were utilized as an exhibit, particularly the head and shoulders, with either admission being charged or donations highly incurred. Additionally, in France, they had lotteries, events, and entertainment to help raise the money. Once complete, the statue had been displayed in Paris for roughly a year, and on July 4th, 1884, it was presented to Levi Morton, the American minister to France, after which it was disassembled into 350 parts and packed into 214 crates, according to an article on the New Jersey government official website. Once the ultimate IKEA traveled across the Atlantic, it had arrived in New York on July 17th, 1885. After a bit of excitement and general fanfare, the pieces were left there while the base was still being built. Not to give spoilers, it would take just over another 16 months before the statue was dedicated and standing. So for the moment, let's leave the boxes on Bedloe's Island and see what was going on with the Americans.
Now, if you remember, the American Committee was supposed to be responsible for the pedestal, and in the US, they focused on events, arts, and auctions, and prize fights to attempt to raise money for the statue. However, they were running into one major conflict. The rich elite in America simply had no interest in funding the statue. To be completely frank, there were multiple people and families, especially in New York City, who had already readily funded their own projects for a fraction of what the base was projected to cost. But most of those projects came with some sort of return, whether in social status, monetarily, commercial value, etc. I won't drop any names, but safe to say, they couldn't even get the project started in the US at first. There was a lot of sources implying that it was a pretty embarrassing moment for the Americans when the statue arrived, as the Americans had officially run out of money in 1884. Luckily for us, Bartholdi and Joseph Pulitzer were able to save the day. Joseph Pulitzer, yes, the Hungarian immigrant, politician, and publisher, whose will would later go on to establish the Pulitzer Prize, came up with an ingenious way to raise money. For every person who donated to the statue, he would publish their names in this newspaper. It was also great for him, because now he has a ton of excited people purchasing papers each week, excitedly looking for their shout-out. I will read you a quote from the March 16, 1885 front page article trying to raise funds. Quote, "We must raise the money. The world is the people's paper, and it now appeals to the people to come forward and raise the money. The $250,000 that the making of the statue cost was paid in by the masses of the French people, by the working men, the tradesmen, the shops girls, the artisans. By all, irrespective of class or condition, let us respond in a like manner. Let us not wait for the millionaires to give this money. It is not a gift from the millionaires of France to the millionaires of America, but a gift of the whole people of France to the whole people of America." And the thing is, it worked extremely well. This was featured on the front page of his New York World. In around 6 months' time, they managed to raise $100,000, which today would be equivalent to just over 3 million USD and just under 3 million euros. But the majority of the donations were for around a dollar, which today would be equivalent to 30 bucks. The money wasn't raised in large sweeping sums, but instead raised penny by penny by excited families, children, and groups by a total of 120,000 contributors. As the article stated, it wasn't from the millionaire. The Statue of Liberty was from the people. Other efforts did continue alongside Pulitzer's campaign, including utilizing the pamphlet I mentioned that Bartholdi wrote earlier in the episode, as well as displaying the arms and torch in Philly and New York, respectively. Another fun way was using Bartholdi's patents. As owner of the patent, he was able to sell miniatures and encourage donations. Several museums currently display these items, and I will link them in the blog, so please check it out now that it's released. However, one of arguably the most important fundraisers actually occurred in 1883, during an arts and literary auction. Several writers contributed pieces, one of which was a single sheet of lined paper that would be read at the start of the auction, after which this manuscript was left on display, like a moment suspended in time, part of a larger exhibit that would eventually be removed when the goal for the funds was achieved. But for now, this is where I'm going to leave you today, suspended with that manuscript as a moment in time. Thank you once again for tuning into this episode. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe everywhere you get your podcast from. You can find me on Instagram at architecturecoffeeandink, email the show at architecturecoffeeandink@gmail.com, or the blog at architecturecoffeeandink.com. Don't worry, all those will be linked in the show notes down below. Architecture Coffee and Ink is a Hollywood C Studios production. I am excited to meet with all my designers, dreamers, and DIY enthusiasts next time. But in the meantime, may your coffee mugs be full and your inkwells never run dry.